Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Think what you do when you run in debt. You give another power over your liberty. 250 years ago, Benjamin Franklin published that adage and many more in a volume called The Way to Wealth. Americans think of that all-purpose founding father as the great preacher of thrift and prudence as the way to prosperity. Yet for years now, Americans have motored along on credit card debt, home equity loans, and stock market rolls of the dice. With the economy changing, maybe no more. This hour on point, the end of easy money in the USA and Ben Franklin's advice on the way to wealth 250 years ago and today. Joining me first today from New York is Michael Mandel, chief economist at Business Week. Michael Mandel, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm great. We're all watching the news this week. Market off like crazy yesterday. Tough economic news again. You've written as early as last fall that it's been a glorious run for the consumer these last 25 years. But the subprime crisis is the beginning of the end for the long consumer borrow and buy boom. What's happening?
Well, I think this lasted a lot longer than anybody expected. I mean, for the last 25 years, lenders looked at consumers as if they were low risk. Low risk. You know, that you could lend to Americans, you could lend mortgages, credit cards, and you'd get it paid back. And all of a sudden, the lenders have discovered that that's not true, that you can lose a lot of money lending to consumers. And I think we're going to see a very rapid undoing of this willingness.
But it's the American culture at this point, Michael. New York Times writing this week, you know, Americans may have to turn over a whole new leaf or go back in time, pay as you go, throw out the credit cards, not just here and there, not just, as a moment's joke or impulse, but really a fundamental culture shift in the country. Can you see that?
The culture shift will come eventually, but the first step is actually going to be much more pragmatic. The first step is that the lenders, the credit card companies, the mortgage lenders are going to cut back. They're going to make it a lot harder to get loans, a lot harder to get credit cards. So the first step is not that we all find religion and we all discover thrift. The first step is that we're cut off. So, you know, and then afterwards there's going to be a cultural shift. So right now we're in stage one, and the stage one is the retrenchment on the part of the banks and the credit card companies, and it's going to be very, very painful for a lot of people who have depended on being able to borrow basically for their luxuries and for daily life.
You know, we're going to have some fun thinking about Benjamin Franklin in his simple adages and in his complexity today. But what's your sense culturally, Michael Mandel? I mean, this is part of Americans' heritage, the sort of penny saved is a penny earned maxims of Franklin. Do we have a different culture, not a credit card culture, not a home equity loan culture, but a different culture that's still alive enough that this country in 2008, 9, 10, 11, 12 can fall back on it?
And I think that people have always felt kind of nervous about debt. And if you look at the last 20 years, 25 years, what's really happened is that it's been the financial industry which has been pushing credit card, pushing people, okay? That is to say, this has been marketed, and that's why you've gotten so many credit cards in the mail. And I think it's not going to be as quick as flipping a switch. There's going to be a transition period, which is going to be very painful for a lot of people. But I do think eventually there will be a cultural shift. I don't like saying that Americans were spendthrift before, and now they're going to become savers. That's not really what's going to happen. What's going to happen is that they're going to be cut off from debt, and when they're cut off from debt, they're going to discover then the virtues of savings. So it's going to be a little bit more forced than virtuous. It's going to be ex post virtue.
But even forced, I mean, in history, that's had an effect. I remember well a grandmother who would, you know, darn every sock with a hole in the toe, unthinkable in the time of, you know, I don't know, 20-cent socks at Walmart. But I mean, there was a time, and it was not so many generations back, when people quoted Benjamin Franklin, penny saved, penny earned, very sincerely, and some of them, many from the Depression era, worked to live by that.
That's exactly right. So, you know, I think that one big difference between now and then is still going to be true, that some types of sort of high risk investments, whether it's in stocks or sort of or in kind of in your human capital and careers, are going to be necessary to get ahead. We're never gonna go back to the idea of being clam like and closed up. We're going to have to sort of find some intermediate sort of place. But what is true is that the culture of borrow and spend has probably come to an end.
Wow. And that was a great age indeed, at least in its dimensions. If that comes down, that's a lot coming down.
It's a lot coming down. I did a story just for Business Week just last week where I calculated that the excess spending over the last sort of 10 years have come to basically $3 trillion. That's excess spending. That is kind of where Americans spend over and above the growth rate of the economy. Wow. And if you look back, we also added on roughly about $3 trillion in debt, more than we would have in the past. So that's really kind of the size. That's the size of the potential excess. I'm not quite sure that whether it's all excess or not, but there's a sense in which, especially in the last 5 or 6 years or so, that we kind of exceeded the capabilities of what the economy is able to generate.
$3 trillion, that's a big number. If we're sopping that up, we may look in lots of directions for solace and guidance along the way. That's a new vector to be on. Michael Mandel at Business Week Magazine, chief economist there, joining us from New York. Michael, thanks a lot for being here today.
Thanks.
We're looking back to the guy who wrote, "The borrower is a slave to the lender," wrote, "Fools make feasts and wise men eat them." The guy who wrote the very simple stuff, "Early to bed and early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise," Benjamin Franklin. This is the 250th anniversary year of his book, really just kind of a long pamphlet, The Way to Wealth. He's a complicated guy. Some simple maxims there that people may be clinging on to. Now we're going to try and look at the whole picture today. Joining me now in the studio is Jill Lepore. She's a professor of history at Harvard University. Her article on Ben Franklin and his book, The Way to Wealth, appears in the January 28th edition of the New Yorker magazine. Jill Lepore, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Remind us of what this book was.
Well, it wasn't actually a book at first. It was the preface to a book. Franklin had been printing. He was a printer in Philadelphia from his 20s in the 1720s, and he had been printing Poor Richard's Almanac every year. And
with sun and moon and tides and everything that farmers
need. Basically like a date book, a kind of glorified date book, but for farmers and small tradesmen to use to keep their appointments and keep track of the weather and record their debts is among the things that people would use. People didn't have a lot of books. They would just have an almanac, and you'd use it as an account book as much as anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And printers filled the kind of blank pages on the date book with proverbs and poems and doggerel.
In the margins to keep them coming back to see what little tidbit they might pick up.
And have a kind of little kind of personality for this date book.
Mm-hmm.
And Franklin's Poor Richard's Almanac became the best-selling almanac in the American colonies because it was hilarious. Franklin was incredibly witty, and his adages were just funnier, and they were also wiser. Franklin didn't write most of what we call Poor Richard's Proverbs.
Right.
He edited them, and he was a great editor. And one of the things that makes those proverbs memorable and have that feeling of wit and wisdom is just they're like haiku. I mean, they're just beautiful little pieces. And so The Way to Wealth was the last of Franklin's prefaces to his Poor Richard's Almanac. In 1757, he was getting ready to go to London, where he was going to be lobbying Parliament to deal with colonial taxation.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote a little essay in the voice of Poor Richard, who was kind of his alter ego, the alleged astrologer who was the author of the almanacs.
Threadbare, good man.
Franklin always said that Poor Richard's guy named Richard Saunders wrote the almanacs, when of course everyone knew it was Franklin.
Mm-hmm.
But that was part of the joke.
Mm-hmm.
And so The Way to Wealth is really Poor Richard's story of going to an auction on his horse and tying up his horse and hearing an old man get up on a bench and offer a speech to the people who were about to go into the auction, in which he basically says, "Don't go waste all your money on a bunch of junk. And this is how you will live a better life."
Mm-hmm. And puts together all these adages, all these maxims, weaves them into one long speech.
Yeah. So there had been 25 years of Poor Richard's Almanacs at this point, and there were about 600 proverbs in them. And
about, I read somewhere that there were 100 and some editions in no time, and maybe 1,000 or more editions of this have been published by now.
Poor Richard's Way to Wealth is by far the most famous of all of Franklin's writing, even more known than his autobiography, which is just a canonical piece of American literature. And it has, I think, it partly because it's so kind of clippable and because children memorize them for so many generations, they're a little addictive. When I was writing this piece, you know, I memorized, I think, like half of them just inadvertently. And I have three little boys, and I would say to them, I would, you know, trot out the adages to get them to do their, homework, and idleness is the greatest prodigality. And
God helps them who help themselves.
If your head is made of wax, don't walk in the sun. And finally, my 6-year-old said, Mom, you know what poor Richard used to say? Mommy, shut up. You know, it becomes very tiresome. You can see how quickly they turn to a kind of preachy,
annoying. D.H. Lawrence complained about that. Mark Twain complained about that. But there they are. They're back in our history. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about maybe a new era in the way Americans think about money and debt. And as we do, we're looking back to Benjamin Franklin, his treatise, The Way to Wealth, 250 years old this year, a penny saved is a penny earned, and all that. His advice, a quarter of a millennium ago, well, maybe due for a comeback, given where our economy is headed. I'm joined in the studio by Jill Lepore, professor of early American history at Harvard University. Lovely article on Benjamin Franklin she just had in The New Yorker, the January 28th edition there. We're joined as well right now from New York by Teresa Ghilarducci, professor of economics at the New School for Social Research. She's a leading national expert on savings and retirement security in particular. Teresa, thanks for being here.
You're welcome.
So, Teresa, let me just reel off a few of these and ask you if you think these are resonant today or if this sounds like ancient history. What have we got here from Ben Franklin? He says, the borrower is a slave to the lender. Mm-hmm. Rather go to bed supperless than rise in debt. Industry pays debt while despair increaseth them. And then there's that no pain, no gain line from the original master. There are no gains without pains. Does this stuff still resonate to Americans today? Can we resurrect an interest in this kind of talk, or does it just sound preachy and old-timey, Teresa?
Well, it does sound preachy, but it's not old. Up until the 1980s, Americans were living that way. The financial institutions in our lives were insurance companies, pension funds, banks, and they were all oriented towards getting our savings and making money by helping us manage our savings. Insurance companies managed the risks that we were taking in our lives. And it was only, 25 years ago. But the business model for financial institutions really changed. So I agree with Michael Mandel. It's not a cultural problem. It's actually a business model problem where financial institutions and let's remember car companies, General Electric, decided that they could make more money being debt purveyors, you know, sort of debt pushers, like heroin pushers,
mortgage lenders.
Mm-hmm. Right. I want to just follow his analogy a little bit more. If we are addicted to, let's say, heroin and we're cut off, then that will change our culture. But it's not in the hearts of Americans to actually want to be in debt. But it was It was a temptation put in front of us. So let's just do a little bit of history. So right around the 80s, we have the growth of 401k plans and the decline of traditional pension plans. Unions actually were institutions that in collective bargaining encouraged groups of workers to save for the future, not only in pension funds, but also to put some money away for vacations, time off. All that was paid for out of current consumption, you know, a little bit of pain for future gain. Well, unions are in decline, 401ks are in the ascendancy, and then we have a new financial institution in our lives. Not only do we have the credit card companies and General Motors and General Electric making more money selling loans than selling cars and light bulbs, but we also have another industry that is going to help us make money without us having to save. So a penny earned was no longer coming from a penny saved. A penny earned was coming from picking the right stocks. So we have Cramer in our life. We have the Motley Fools in our life. And they give us an illusion of kind of financial sophistication. And then if you were really sophisticated, then you cared about how your money was spent between stocks and bonds. But it was all oriented towards taking their advice, paying for their advice, and really getting rich quick. And then we have the government deciding to raise money not through taxes but through lotteries. Again, they had to sell the idea that getting rich quick was a way to wealth and security, not savings. So this is an important kind of teaching moment for us to remind us the way we were, even just as recently as 25 years ago.
And you're saying not so much individuals, but whole institutions moving away from that perspective on the world. Jill Lepore, I want to get a sense, though, a kind of reality check on how good, how pure anybody ever was. Ben Franklin always had that famous twinkle of irony in his eye when he got done with this long speech in The Way to Wealth. I mean, he ends up quoting Poor Richard saying, "If you will not hear reason, she'll surely rap your knuckles." And the crowd has stood and listened to all this. But then he quotes Poor Richard saying that when the old gentleman ended his harangue, the people heard it and approved the doctrine, all this upright behavior, and immediately practiced the contrary. America's not exactly straight up by Franklin's maxims in 1757 or 8 either.
They surely didn't. And I think Franklin also understood, you know, Poor Richard also said the golden age was never the present age. Franklin had a great sense that we would look upon his era in a different way than he looked upon it himself, and the same way that we can look on the 1980s or the pre-1980 years as an age in which this ideal of thrift did have more cultural currency than it does now. Not that that's not a trenchant observation and an important one, but I think that there's a kind of rush to the use of history here that that Franklin would have appreciated with a somewhat ironic sense.
Ironic, and yet he himself a strove for moral perfection very explicitly, and he put out these maxims in part to make a buck, and he did very well by them. But was there not also a sense of I'm trying to, I don't know, shape up here a kind of a guidebook for my fellow young countrymen?
Absolutely. I think he did mean it sincerely. But I think that he also made a selection. You know, he abridged his wisdom to something that would be serviceable at a time when Americans were facing very difficult economic circumstances. But what happened to the Way to Wealth in the 19th century when it was so popular, especially in kind of capitalizing, industrializing America, was that the context in which Franklin wrote it, which was a context of a real commitment to virtue. I mean, he thought about titling his autobiography The Art of Virtue, that for him, thrift was a virtue, and in the end was virtue. Mm-hmm. The end of thrift was virtue, not wealth. And so that I think if you look at kind of the totality, even just of the Proverbs, you get a great sense of the role that virtue and the idea of moral perfection and the idea of doing good and usefulness played in Franklin's ideas.
There's another piece just at the end here. He talks about his doctrine, all these, you know, save your pennies, work hard, be wise. Then he says, "This doctrine, my friends, is reason and wisdom. But after all, do not depend too much upon your own industry and frugality and prudence, though excellent things, for they may all be blasted without the blessing of heaven. And therefore, ask that blessing humbly and be not uncharitable to those that at present seem not to want it, but comfort and help them. Remember, Job suffered and was afterward prosperous." So it's not all about industry and business and the buck. But there's sure a lot of guidance in that direction. Maybe we need it once again. Let's turn to our listeners. Nick is calling from South Kingstown, Rhode Island. Nick, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
Very well. What do you think, Nick?
Well, I was thinking that a lot of what Benjamin Franklin says still rings true today. The way society is set up with institutions, we rely on borrowing money. And it, from what I see, that you can't live without borrowing money. And I think that that's a problem, especially in today's age of consumerism and advertising, that we're digging ourselves in a hole and we just keep getting deeper and deeper. And I don't really see a way out right now.
Can you imagine Americans turning around and starting to quote all this old stuff again that people eventually got sick of hearing and is sort of passed out of common currency now? Can you imagine coming back? Could we have a whole turnover?
To an extent, I don't think everybody's going to jump on a Ben Franklin bandwagon, but I think the same themes and the same ideas will reoccur, because people will start to realize, you know, oh, maybe I don't need this plasma TV, or I don't need to buy a fancy new car, and maybe if I save my money, I can do something else that is more financially sensible. And I think it's more like the idea that there really is no original idea, that people will figure it out again, is something that I believe will happen.
And as Michael Mandel said, we may have to. Nick, thanks for your call. Let's get one more from Brattleboro, Vermont. Scott, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
First of all, I've never had a credit card until recently when I got my bank card, which I can use for deposits and stuff like that.
Where have you been all this time, Scott? The whole country's got a stack of credit cards.
I'm proud to live in a means that reflects my my ability to earn.
You're after poor Richard's heart. What do you think now? What's going on out there, Scott?
Well, I think that people having money that they may be even planning when they spend it not to pay back really fuels the creation of products which are poor in quality, things like cell phones, which don't work any better than the phones did back in the 30s and 40s, and this thing of turning technology over every 6 months or every year and making everyone buy stuff new as it gets better and closer to the point where it's easy for people to use. I think if people didn't have the money to spend with their credit cards and actually had to pay for stuff with money that they've earned, that they would be a lot more discerning and a lot more demanding in terms of the products and technology and how easy it is to use, how accessible, and the quality of it. You know, these days, if you want a good tool, you go to the flea market and you buy something that was made 100 years ago in Miller's Falls or someplace like that.
Yep.
And most of the stuff that you get in that these days is there's some washer in there that should be metal that was plastic instead, and you use it and it burns out and nothing's any good. And it seems like if people, you know, had to say, well, I'm not going to buy that thing until it works, until I know that it's good quality, that all these companies that are creating technology and living off of this extra money that people don't actually have would have to work a little bit harder, and we'd see everything around us get a little bit stronger and a little bit better quality. And
Yeah, Scott, you've got a big view. You've got us in the way back machine there, and it sounds kind of good. Teresa, Scott puts credit behind all that. I mean, credit has been incredibly easy for a long time and never more than in recent years. Franklin has all his things to say about borrowing, but we have come to think of it as second nature. And Scott sees a kind of insidious, deep effect, not just on consumer spending, but on the whole world around us.
Oh, it's very sophisticated analysis. What he does is say, once we can borrow money, we can spend more than we want. The irony is that we demand things that are actually disposable. So he links the more debt with actually low-quality goods, which, of course, goes back to our trade policies with China. You can go to Europe and you can see that when food is more expensive, when goods are more expensive, you actually have much more discerning consumers. So, Nick, you know, in just a course of a less than 1 minute comment to us, he went from saying, I can't live without borrowing, to at the end of his little comment, which is, well, maybe we'll now stop buying our plasma TVs, which he couldn't even say we need. So it might become cool again to have high-quality goods or to live within our means. But it probably will be pushed upon us because we can't get debt. But there is a link. He's right that there is a link between the dissatisfaction we have with our lives and the stuff that we have, and going back to the well and getting more and more in debt. But that will be cut off.
And yet, Jill Lepore, I mean, Ben Franklin contained universes, I guess. This was a guy who knew and loved the high life in London and Paris and the great cities, had his fur hat but also his silk stockings. I mean, Americans have always kind of wanted it both ways, to be and feel and be seen as virtuous. And yet to have all that stuff. And Franklin had a fair bit of that fine life himself.
Franklin did, and I think that's part of his complexity. He understood that it was a constant battle against luxury, that virtue was in a constant battle against luxury. But one of the things that I just want to pick up on here, its core 18th century value is the notion that debt is slavery. And so to be a slave is to be dependent and therefore to be a poor citizen.
And this was a time when they knew of what they spoke,
they
of
knew
slavery
of what they
and
spoke,
servants.
Right? It's not merely a metaphor, but to be in debt to another is to be a slave to that man. And so for Franklin and for most people in the 18th century who believed in the ideals of a virtuous Republican citizenry, debt was utterly corrupting to the Republic. It wasn't just a question of your private virtue and were you going to go to heaven. It was a question of whether the democracy, whether the government could thrive and survive with the people who were indebted. And I think some of that has been picked up on the last caller in particular, kind of suggesting some kind of grosser moral taint.
But have we somehow grown beyond that risk of servitude to debt, of a debased citizenry because of debt? I mean, we accept it again as second nature now. Jill, or Teresa?
Yeah. There is an institution that is actually thriving because of debt, and that's actually many employers. One thing that we've seen in the last 20 years with the growth of debt is the growth of the fear of job loss. Even at low rates of unemployment, we have lots of people saying that they're afraid of losing their jobs or finding a job just like the one they have if they lose the one they have. That gives an enormous amount of power to employers to debase the job in terms of pay or to actually cause people to work longer. Much of this is because people are living month to month and they can't go they can't go on an extended job search. So there is actually a lot of people making money on this debt-led economy. And that's actually the 17th century meaning of slavery, that you're indebted and a slave to your employer.
Jill, do you know history well? Do you see Americans thinking differently, behaving differently as a result of indebtedness, even though it may be second nature to us now? Do you see a degraded citizen in the process, or does it sound too Franklinian?
Well, you know, I can comment on that as a layperson. I think we are distracted by our debts, and I think they distract us from the public good and concern us more with our private interests than maybe we ought to be concerned. And I think our political culture speaks to that. Appeals are made to us on the basis of our private interests and not on the basis of the public good. And I think that's a long strand in American political culture, but I think it's maybe at a bit of a peak at the moment, and that might be related to this. But I speak on that really as a lay observer, since my concern historically is much earlier. But I think that Franklin is greatly to be consulted with on the idea that wealth corrupts, that prosperity discovers vice, that success has ruined many a man, that Franklin is very wise and offers a lot of observations on the dangers of wealth for wealth's sake, wealth except for virtue's sake.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about what may be the end of easy money in the USA, at least for a while, and taking a look back to the Ben Franklin of the Way to Wealth fame, a penny saved is a penny earned and all that. 250 years old this year, 1758. Now here we are in 2008, facing a changing economy, and maybe right now not for the better. Jill Lepore joins us. She's a professor of early American history at Harvard University. Had a wonderful piece on the way to wealth in the New Yorker magazine last week. She's author of New York Burning, Liberty and Slavery in an 18th Century City, most recently in 2005. And Teresa Ghilarducci joins us from New York. She's a professor of economics at the New School for Social Research, leading expert on retirement security. Did you grow up with Ben Franklin's aphorisms in your ear, or are these all history now? Is a borrower still a slave to the lender? Are you a slave to MasterCard? Is Franklin's advice just for suckers today? Is the smart money still fast and easy? What do you think when you hear, let's look on down his list. Buy what thou hast no need of, and ere long thou shalt sell thy necessaries. Or, for age and want, save while you may, no morning sun lasts a whole day. Or, they that won't be counseled can't be helped. Does it sound preachy or welcome these days? Cadra's calling from Gloucester, Massachusetts. Hi, Cadra, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm glad that there is attention being paid to Benjamin Franklin and the value of frugality and virtue there's so much attention being paid to the recession and how people are spending only out of necessity. That's painted in a negative light. There's also a lot of attention being paid to global warming and the environment and China. Mm. However, nobody seems to be making a connection between the waste created by our conspicuous consumption and the state of the environment.
So live like old Ben, and you may not only have a better bank account, but a better world, a better environment.
Right.
Can Teresa?
Jump in, because... Yeah. It is confusing because our national leaders are saying that the way that we can solve our economic problems is by spending. We've had this perversion of Keynesian economics named after John Maynard Keynes, who gave us some recipes about how to get out of the Great Depression. And that's been turned into, well, it's a patriotic thing to do, and the right thing to do is to spend, spend, and spend. When in fact the message is that the government, through careful targeting of spending and maybe careful debt from the government, could actually spur an economy to growth. It doesn't mean that if we go buy socks from China or take a trip to Disneyland, that that will get us on a long-term growth path. So no wonder we're confused when we say that we're more economically insecure, but the way out of that is spending more, you know, in an indiscriminate way.
Ben Franklin writing, if you would be wealthy, think of saving as well as of getting. The Indies have not made Spain rich because her outgoes are greater than her incomes. Lord knows our outgoes are plenty large today. Jill Lepore, did Franklin have a position on state spending? I know he was very opposed to taxation when it was at least imposed from London. But was in his pre-Keynesian time, did he even imagine a young American government that would live way beyond its means? Do you know?
Well, Franklin was not an economist, and he wasn't a man who had an especially systematic philosophy. And so one of the things that's difficult about kind of resurrecting Franklin for this purpose, not to sound the same note, is that this was a very small part of how he thought about the world, and it was subservient to his ideals about education and his ideas about virtue and his ideas about science and the importance of learning. So
money overall in a backseat to his political, philosophical, even scientific interests, which were many.
Absolutely. And I think in a sense, that's part of the problem, right? If we were to resurrect him purely for the sake of using him as a kind of financial prophet, as he is often used. I mean, there's all kinds of, you know, the Businessman's Guide to Ben Franklin's wisdom. I mean, wisdom that was used in the 80s and 90s to support the very kind of spendthrift economy that we are now using Franklin today. I mean, he can be used either way because he embraced a lot of different ideas.
And yet, I mean, he didn't really get fully into that public life until he had made his fortune and was essentially retired. It was very long-lived, what, lived to 84 or something for that time especially. But, I mean, he did go first to his fortune.
He retired from business when he was 42, and he strived greatly as a young man because he came from nothing. And that's one of the things that really distinguishes Franklin from the rest of the founders, who were generally born very wealthy. Franklin was, you know, the 10th son of a tallow maker in Boston who had 17 children. He had no money at all. He had 2 years of schooling. And what he most wanted to communicate to the American people was industry in support of your education so that you could, you know, he turned vegetarian and took his salary in the form of cash so that he could use it to buy books and live on bread and water instead. That Franklin's frugality was always in the service of learning and the service of virtue and not in the service of the accumulation of wealth, which he considered to be a kind of corruption and experienced, I think, in his own life as a kind of corruption, as you suggested.
But as the 10th son of 17, he had sympathy for those who had nothing. He wanted to make them into citizens. There was one, I forget exactly what it says, where he says, an empty bag can't stand.
Can never stand up.
Can't stand up, i.e., people in poverty or perhaps in debt aren't going to be the most virtuous or, in his political view, the best citizens.
And Franklin lived in an era where there is really no economic mobility at all. I mean, he is one
though he was
one
he
person
yeah,
who may,
yeah.
he's the founding storyteller of the idea that you could move from a life of rags to a life of riches. And he's taken for that, but we forget how impossible that was in his age. And so the tools that he's sharing in his Poor Richard's Proverbs are for those very poor Americans who have very little chance of actually getting out of poverty.
Make what you need, get an education, be a good citizen. Gene's calling from Port Republic, Virginia. Hi, Gene, you're on the air.
The quote, wealth discovers vice, is such a keen insight into human nature.
Yes.
A short 20 years after we bested the Soviet Union, we now are having to lower standards for recruits into the military, physical standards, intellectual standards, moral standards, because everybody's gone off into the consumer orgy. I don't know in history if there are any examples of a nation going that route and turning it around. I don't think we can blame the debt situation entirely on purveyors of credit cards or subprime mortgages.
We've all got an oar in there too, maybe, huh?
Well, yeah, we do.
Everybody wants goodies. Everybody, you know, even the conservative Christians were all kinds of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. They don't indulge in that, but they're all down there at the restaurant getting the all-you-can-eat food bar and getting all the consumer toys that everyone else is. You know, Christmas is 1 hour at the mall and 60 hours, 1 hour at church, 60 hours at the mall. We have become a nation of consumer junkies. And I don't know, you know, what Franklin said, that wealth discovers vice. I don't know how you undiscover it, particularly, you know, people don't consider this obsessive consumerism as vice.
Gene, do you see it touching our national politics, our national sense of a citizenship and ourselves?
Oh, it is. I mean, to be a part of the, to feel part of the team when nobody has an awful lot and everybody's working just to sort of keep the society together, prosperity leads everybody off to themselves. And, you know, how can I feather my own nest? How can I make my own situation better? You know, take on more debt, get more toys. I stay in my own home and play with my own toys rather than thinking about the common good. You know, let's make sure we lower the taxes so I can have more toys, and I'll curse the potholed roads, but not think that, you know, that contribution in taxes would take care of the potholes.
Gene, you are terrific, and we really appreciate your contribution. Let me get one more right here from Chesapeake, Virginia. Mike, you're on the air.
I've lived out of debt-free most of my life. Never had a lot of money to begin with. Had a low-paid working job. Saved, put it away. Made a little, you know, in the stock market and mutual funds and stuff. Live simply. Day I retire, my house is paid for. Live on the water. I live a good life. You don't have to live on a credit card. I've never had one. Don't want one.
Mike, it sounds good to me. It sounds good to me. You've managed to put it together. What about those big bad institutions that wanted to tempt you into debt and everything else that Teresa Ghilarducci speaks of?
I just don't follow it. I don't follow it. I don't get into it. I live frugally. You don't have to live on a credit card. You just don't have to do it. And I think too many people get sucked into the hype, the media hype, and it leads to, you know, down the wrong road.
Ben Franklin speaks to you then, I imagine.
Since junior high school, I read Ben, you know, kind of required reading.
Yeah.
And took a consumer math course in high school, learned the rule of 78s and the rule of 72s and all that stuff, and hey, you make more money if you save a little bit.
It sounds like you've done the math pretty well, Mike, and thank you for that. Let me get one more here from Ahmed in Montreal in Canada. Ahmed, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom. Great show today.
Thank you.
I just wanted to mention that I think interest should be off the table completely. Benjamin Franklin, he's right about the master-slave relationship. I think the way of lending and borrowing should be more of a partnership or cooperative, where the lender and the borrower share in the risk of up or down. In Islam, for example, interest is forbidden. So a lot of the Muslims have to find alternatives for interest. And they do that by cooperatives or partnerships. And this avoided all the subprime mess or credit card debt mess and all that.
But interest off the table, Ahmed, I know that's the teaching of Islam, but can you even imagine that in today's world with these giant financial markets spanning continents? I mean, are we just irrevocably beyond that way of seeing the world?
You know, you're correct. It would be a paradigm shift for the whole world the way the world is right now, but I think it would be for the benefit of the lenders and the borrowers. I think overall everybody would do a lot better instead of a minority of people doing very good and a majority of people doing bad.
Ahmed, thanks for calling in with that. And we've got some pushback here from an economist in Charlottesville, Virginia. Armand, you're on the air.
Oh, hello, Tom.
Hi.
Well, respectfully, I'm going to disagree with everybody on your panel and whatever has been said for the past hour.
You're going to disagree with Benjamin Franklin, founder of the nation.
No, I love old Ben. I really do. But, his philosophy does not apply to today's America.
Why not?
And today, today's America is not 1946 America. It's not 1801 America. It's totally different. I mean, we are living in a society now that basically if you don't get it now, you will never get it again. And basically all these problems that they're talking about with the subprime, it will happen again. It's just like getting a speeding ticket, and you will speed again, because there is a nice highway in front of you, and you have to take advantage of this open highway. And basically, I do not blame subprime companies. I don't blame Countrywide. I don't blame anybody. And I don't blame myself either. I mean, if there is an option for me to get a line of credit and purchase a Lincoln brand new and get a tax deduction for it, is it my fault? No. Because the opportunity is there.
But getting it, so your philosophy is sort of get it while the getting's good. And
absolutely.
Franklin, he speaks to that in part. You know, he's got some kind of make hay while the sunshine aphorisms in here. But for a whole society?
Yeah. Absolutely, Tom. Because mentality of today is we hear so many bad news that we have to live for today. Global warming, the problem with the oil, the problem with the other countries. You know what I mean? So today's teenagers, today's youth, I mean, they just want to get it now because it might be too late.
Armand, you make me long for the young country and bemoan living in the old or whatever age we are now. But, Teresa, how about it? I mean, we all heard the kind of greed is good philosophy that was upheld not just as kind of nihilistic grab it before it's too late, but it's positively good for the economy and the country to rev that economy up and grab what you can. Mm-hmm. You know, cumulatively, that's good for everybody.
Yeah, no, I thought that's where he was going with this.
I did
but
too.
But he ended at the nihilistic part, which made me kind of sad to think of teenagers feeling that their life is short and that they need the consumer goods to make up for the lack of a future. I think he's wrong. I think that people are hopeful that they'll live a long time, and they really are taking cues from national leaders and from financial institutions about how to, in economist terms, smooth out their consumption over their lifetimes, maybe live a little bit better every decade, especially, you know, your children. We need lessons from our institutions. Let's go back to the Islamic financing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it sounds preposterous.
No interest. Usury.
Mortgage bankers used to act like that. They were your partner. You came in, and the mortgage banker would say, hey, buddy, you can afford it. Hey, that house is a little bit too large for you.
Mm-hmm.
Let's work together. I want to make sure you don't default, mm-hmm. and I want to make sure that you have a house that you can live in. Actually, I do blame the securitization of these mortgages. Countrywide made it happen. Subprimes made it happen. Because that mortgage banker just became a broker. He sold your loan to somebody else and didn't care if you couldn't afford it.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually had, in our golden age, post-war period, our economy was growing. We were wealthy and we were savers. And we had our financial institutions were partners with us. And that institutional change happened. And I am concerned that we now have adults who are raising children who didn't live under that partnership with financial institutions. And they really didn't do the consumer math in high school and don't know that if you are in debt and you pay the minimum on your credit card, you'll never pay it off. Also, private debt does lead to more work and less time that makes you less of a citizen. And private debt leads to private consumption that leaves you less time to pay for taxes for schools. So that first caller was right,
mm-hmm.
too.
Issues that Ben Franklin would certainly key in on. Jill Lepore, our time grows short. Ben Franklin was around when things were still pretty rough and ready. Did he imagine the wealth that might lie ahead for this young country that he was so important in getting launched? Did he fear that, you know, even his own young nation might one day become rich and subject to the pitfalls of wealth?
I think he saw a lot of the pitfalls of wealth as they operated in Britain and in the British Empire, and I think that's behind a lot of American sense of the corruption of luxury. But I just kind of want to—I have two last Poor Richard proverbs to close out with. One,
great,
just to get back to that prosperity discovers vice. The other half of that proverb is adversity discovers virtue.
Mm.
So maybe there's that.
Thank heavens. We'll
and
hang
then,
on to that.
And then finally, Franklin's own view of how maybe he ought to be looked at by us today.
Mm-hmm.
Let our grandfathers be valued for their goodness, ourselves for our own.
In other words, it's not enough for Ben Franklin to have been good. Let us be valued for our own goodness that we bring up. That's terrific. And we'll look around with care here. Also, he says, a little neglect may breed great mischief. We're not neglecting old Ben today, and we're really grateful for Jill Lepore, all the study and intimate understanding that you bring to us of Ben Franklin. Jill Lepore of Harvard's professor of history at Harvard. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Teresa Ghilarducci, professor of economics at the New School for Social Research in New York. Teresa, wonderful to have you again. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.